This weekend's episode of the Inside Running Podcast is proudly sponsored by our friends at the Arthur's Seat Challenge Fun Run and Walk, which is coming up soon. Check out their website, arthursseatchallenge.com.au, and we'll have a bit more information about this race later on in the podcast. Enjoy the show.
Okay, and we're rolling. Thank you for tuning in. This is the Inside Running Podcast. I feel like we could be calling this Inside Running Inside the Body. My name is Sophie Ryan. My comfort zone is inside the foot. So I have enlisted the expert advice and wonderful company of Kate Smyth. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Soph.
How are you?
I'm really well. How are you doing?
Very good. And I'm really excited because today we're doing a deep dive into gut health and how gut health relates to runners and how it's relevant to runners. So
awesome.
I've got a lot of questions for you. And then we've got a few listener questions, actually. We've got, quite a great response from the Inside Running Podcast community with lots of questions for us. So we'll get into gut health and then we'll hopefully get to some of the listener questions and, have some fun doing it. Cool.
Sounds good.
Kate, I think most of us know the gut digests our food. There is also a huge body of evidence now for the concept of the brain-gut axis. Mm. I'd love you to tell us a bit about this and how it all works.
Mm, sure. So when we look at how the brain and the gut communicates, the gut's actually now called in a lot of research our second brain. And that's for a really good reason, because the brain and the gut is linked like a two-way highway, I guess. Mm. That's the best way to look at it in simplistic terms. And there's a lot of messages that go to and fro these two zones in our bodies that influence or have a broad range of influences throughout our body. And I'll touch on those in a second in terms of how it affects us when things don't go quite so well. But if you just imagine that two-way highway, and we have our vagal nerve and we have our enteric nervous system, I guess that's the best way to sort of encapsulate it, where we've got signaling going two ways. For example, we often don't think, we've heard of serotonin, for example, which is a major neurotransmitter in our brain, and that's helps to modulate our mood, our emotions, our cognition, and it's also our precursor to things like melatonin, which help us sleep. Well, they estimate now between 90 and 95% of that is actually made in the gut.
Amazing.
And then sent up to the brain. Isn't that cool?
Oh my god, that's incredible.
And that's why it's called a second brain.
Yeah.
But it does so much more than just digest our food, our gut in terms of its general function. But that general term brain gut axis is referring to the communication between the brain and the gut, and it's happening in the background. We don't think about it. It's just on autopilot. So often when we find there's inflammation in the gut, there can also be mental health issues or issues even with sleeping, insomnia, for example, that runners can experience. We can find our anxiety is heightened because our GABA, which is metabolized through the microbiome, which we'll talk about in a second. A GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, and whilst the majority of it isn't made in the gut, it is processed by some of our microbiome. So even that can be impacted.
Yeah.
Like the two are just so interconnected, it's not funny.
Yeah.
And
I guess the take home for someone like myself is, don't underestimate the importance of the gut.
Oh, totally.
Like it's not just tuning through your dinner.
Yes.
It's critical for function.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But we also find the signaling the other way, or the the influence the other way as well, and this is really common as well, is when we get stressed and our nervous system and our neurotransmitters are upregulated in terms of our stress ones, and our adrenal hormones like cortisol are raised, that also impacts the gut the other way.
Yeah.
You know, and so you'll notice that there's a lot more inflammation in the gut, and when cortisol is high, you know, our main line of defense like hydrochloric acid goes down.
Yeah.
So it smashes it, and then, you know, we can get other damn things that come on in that shouldn't be in there in mass, you know, other pathogens, other you know, bacteria and parasites and things that come in through that barrier that should be strong.
Yeah. I've just realized, people, you think if someone's stressed at work under the pump, what do they do? Reach for the shit food, the crap. Do you know what I mean? Like, one thing leads to another.
It does. Kind of, it does. And it's not just
processed food, something quick.
Yeah, we do. And that's a bit of a cycle that a lot of people fall into. But typically, I think as athletes, we kind of forget, we kind of put stress into a little containment or bucket, and we think, oh, that's emotional stress.
Yep.
But it's also physical stress. So when we're doing high mileage and really pushing our bodies, that is a stress on the body. And when combined with a busy lifestyle, let's face it, we all have a pretty
busy lifestyle.
You know, living in this century is pretty fast paced. And so we kind of often we forget the most basic of things, like sitting down to eat and be relaxed.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people are eating at their desk in front of their computer. They're shoving breakfast down in the car. They're eating on the run. They're not even allowing their digestion to have a chance to break it down. They're chucking things down like a brick and then saying, stomach, cop this,
break it down. With it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's so common.
Yeah.
And then the gut thinkers, and this is a question I often ask in clinic as a clinical naturopath, is that I ask people, so when you get worried, do you feel things in your tummy? Like, does your tummy churn? Are you a bit of a gut thinker? And inevitably they are.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first place that we tend to feel stress is often in our gut as well. Yeah. You feel that really uncomfortable churning, that bloating, that, oh boy, something's not quite right here.
It's not just butterflies in your tummy.
No, it's more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Nice way to start. Okay. Kate, what are some of the common gut issues that runners experience and what causes them?
By far the most common thing I see frequently is some of the general symptoms of leaky gut is so common. And leaky gut is a term that we use where there's inflammation in the gut, and that can happen both through having the wrong foods, or as I mentioned, not looking after generally the gastrointestinal health, eating quite high acidic foods or foods that are processed, for example, can set off a bit of a systemic cascade of inflammation. And when the gut gets really inflamed, it throws out symptoms like nausea, definitely frequency of needing to go and urgency of needing to go pretty quickly. Number twos I'm talking. Cramping, gas. Women complain a lot about bloating. We can get a bit of upper gastric issues, like with a bit of reflux is fairly common as well. And we can get things like gnawing. And gnawing is like hunger pains on steroids, like gnawing. It's really loud and it actually almost hurts the gnawing sensation as well. And that's one of the key sort of signs that your stomach acid is quite low at that point in time. A number of other things, you know, that you see, but that's one of them. Things even like bad breath.
Yep.
It's not actually always to do with oral cavity. It can be, but it can also more be to do with your digestion further down the track. So they're just general symptoms that I see. But in terms of conditions or underlying issues, I mentioned the leaky gut. And the leaky gut, in simple terms, leaky gut is when we've got these beautiful tight junctions that keep our stomach together. And if you think in the lining of our tummy, if you just imagine holding your hands together with your fingers woven together, that's probably the best way to sort of imagine what your open, tight junctions look like.
Open palm.
Yep, an open palm looking down, and then your fingers are weaved. together. And then what happens with leaky gut is that those fingers come apart, or the junctions in our tummy come apart in our stomach. And what happens is that particles, larger particles that should stay in the gut lumen and be broken down further, you know, into smaller particles before they go into the bloodstream, they go through in a bigger size.
Right.
So on the other side, where the blood is, you know, in our arteries and what have you, our immune system, it's getting the bigger particles than what it's used to. And the immune system goes, that's not normal. What the hell's going on? That should be in the gut. I'm going to try and set off an immune reaction because this shouldn't be here. Like, it's a protective mechanism that
I'll
we have.
I'll help. I'm the immune system. I'll come in and get your food.
Well, more all recognizing it as something that shouldn't be there, like a foreign substance of some kind. So it's helpful in one way, but unfortunately, when our immune system does that, our symptoms tend to be exacerbated. Our gut symptoms, like bloating and loose stools, and sometimes we can get mucus. Definitely if there's inflammation in the gut, we'll see mucus, like, which is like a slime around our stool. Sometimes if it progresses more and there's underlying conditions, we can get small traces of blood come through as well, and we can see things like our food being undigested properly, whole range of stuff that can happen. And then we get these other systemic influences, like we might get like a sinus problems, or we might get rashes. All of these are often caused, originated by a leaky gut situation, where we might be having foods as well on top of some of our other lifestyle stuff that are aggravating us for whatever reason. We're a bit inflamed and we may react to, for example, dairy, or we may react to wheat, or we may react to eggs, for example. And this is the kind of the process that happens. So the immune system is kind of going, oh, this shouldn't be in this part of the body. I'm going to set off this immune reaction.
And what causes the stomach, that woven thing, what causes that to loosen?
Often, the most common thing is stress, because the cortisol will come down. And it's a bit of a cascade. When cortisol is high and sustained for long periods of time, then the hydrochloric acid, which is our first line of defense, we've got to think of ourselves and our digestion like a hollow tube. That's the easiest way to think of it. And the inside of our hollow tube is just as important as, say, our skin on our exterior in terms of our immune defense. So it's critical that that is really robust. And what happens is, when we're stressed, and our hydrochloric acid is like one of our first lines of defense on the internal tube, inside tube. And when that gets lowered, as a response to high cortisol continuously, or other things as well, like antacids, other drugs will lower it as well. And what happens then is that we have this mucus layer, or mucal layer, sorry, not mucus, mucal layer, that is like this, let's call it soft plasticine on the inside. It's not quite like that, but it's another way of catching pathogens and things before they get into our system. That will also be damaged when there's inflammation. And then behind that is our tight junctions. So if the outside protective layer of our tight junctions isn't robust, then those tight junctions are more vulnerable to pulling apart. But usually the underlying issue is inflammation and cortisol, and they usually come hand in hand together.
That's good, Kate. I want to ask you, what's the go with some female runners having loose stools and a real urgency to go to the toilet just before they get their period?
And this is an interesting one, because our gut also metabolizes some of our estrogen. Well, the microbiome in our gut metabolizes some of our estrogens. So if we don't have good gut clearance, we can also get, you know, dysregulation with our hormones as well, unfortunately. Another thing that the gut does. It does so many.
Number 587.
I know, right? But it's when our hormones decline at the end of a natural cycle, the actual prostaglandins, which is a compound that is pro-inflammatory, let's just call it a pro-inflammatory compound, and they will increase. And those prostaglandins are responsible for things like sore or tender chest as well, like some
female runners get sore boobs beforehand. And it's also responsible for our bowels getting a bit looser.
Yep.
So it's quite common. Mm. And the key to minimizing that is back to hormonal balance,
yeah.
but also just increasing the amount of things like magnesium you have before a period that will dampen down any discomfort or cramping, and things like increasing your essential fatty acids right before. So I'm talking fish oils, chia seeds, flaxseed, all the good essential fatty acids.
If you're doing all those things but you still experience different bowel movements around the time of your period, is it can you consider it like, okay, it's happening, it's normal, it's okay, and perhaps just plan your run a little bit accordingly? You know, okay, I know if I go there, there's no toilets, it's going to be difficult, but hey, if I go in that route, well, there's almost toilets every 2 to 3K, so I'll be good.
Yeah.
So rather than worry, would I be safe to say, I can relate to this, it's happened to me, and go, I can do all these things to try and prevent it or mitigate it a little bit. But if it's happening, it's okay. It's the prostaglandins.
Mm.
That's okay. And perhaps just plan accordingly, kind of.
Well, yes, absolutely. But I think if it's happening chronically, then there's still a level of inflammation that needs to be addressed.
Yeah,
and then maybe you need some more therapeutic sort of intervention, like turmeric or other things that could be natural to help dampen that process down.
Yeah.
But certainly it's not something, you know, if it's just happening every now and again, it's not something that you need to really be too concerned of.
Yeah.
If it's chronic, then it's maybe worthwhile getting other investigations just to make sure there isn't other things going on in the gut that is causing, you know, this urgency and what have you.
Yeah.
But if it's just cyclical...
And
very mild... there's certain other things that you could do to help with estrogen modulation, or, you know, there's a whole range of different things that you can do to actually support that balance. But certainly planning accordingly is very useful.
Yeah. Helps. If possible.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. As a naturopath, Kate, in clinic, you discuss digestion every day with your patients.
Yeah, I do.
But most of us have no idea what is normal and what is not normal in terms of bodily functions.
Mm.
Now, I think the listeners of this podcast have come to realize I'm quite open with things, and you're very open. You're a healthcare practitioner. I'm a healthcare practitioner. It's just bowel movements. It's just the wheeze and the poos. It's not really a big deal. I don't think we need to be awkward and uncomfortable, and I don't think our listeners need to feel uncomfortable about simple bodily functions.
Yeah.
But can you give us a quick rundown of what's normal?
What's like, a normal
what
poo?
What do I look like?
Yeah,
what do I
sure.
not smell like? Well, smell like, but, you know, what's normal?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So from a clinical setting, and I'm sure if people have been hospitals, they use this a lot as well, but I use it in a clinic, is a typical chart we use is the Bristol stool chart, and that gives us a good idea of what is normal and what is abnormal. And usually if we're looking at a stool, a good healthy stool, meaning the digestive tract is relatively balanced and healthy, then the form of a stool is a bit like a sausage. It's kind of literally about the same size. It's about medium brown. If we find our stools are floating or they're paler in color, then there's a bit of malabsorption, often fat malabsorption coming through, which then has impacts on things like your absorption of your essential fat soluble vitamins, you know, like vitamin D and K, essential for bone health, things like A and E, you know, antioxidants as well. So we've got to keep an eye on things like that in terms of the stool color, most definitely. It's usually smooth and soft and fairly easy to pass.
Yes.
If it's coming out like hard pellets, that can typically be dehydration. And constipation is often what people experience. If it's coming out too loose and there's foods coming through, you know, we're other than corn, corn's a typical thing that we notice all the time. But usually, you know, we shouldn't be seeing things like our spinach coming through, nuts and seeds whole. You know, if they're coming through whole and they're nuts and seeds, it's really suggesting that you're not masticating, you're not chewing enough before things are coming through. and
that mechanical breakdown.
That mechanical breakdown's got to happen. Yeah. You've got to give it a hand at the first stage, the cephalic phase, which is that first stage in our mouth. And I really try and encourage people to start to fall in love with their food again. Don't just think of it. Taste it.
Yep.
You know, enjoy making it. When we're cooking our foods, take time to just appreciate the smell, the aroma, the color, chopping it up and have a little bit of carrot. You know, all those simple little things will help start our digestion as well.
Yeah.
And we forget about that in a busy world. Gotta eat quick, I'm hungry, throw it down. You know, or we're eating processed quick meals or whatever, and we're just heating them. We're not even going through that first phase.
Yeah.
So sorry, back we digress, but back onto a healthy stool.
Back to the poo. What does it look like?
So as I said, generally mid-brown, fully formed, should come away easily. Another sign that we might be having possibly the wrong kind of fats or too much fat will be a sticky stool that needs cleaning off the bowl.
Right.
We should just be able to flush and we don't, not a problem. Or if there's too much of things floating and we see a lot of matter in there. Now, we can be having a little bit too much fiber in our diet. Yeah. That's possible too.
Yeah.
But generally, if that's happening, there's something not quite right with enough enzymes breaking things down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should runners or should people and your patients be looking in the toilet and taking notice of these things? Because I remember you asking me, you said, does your poo sink or swim? Like sink or float? And I was like, I was actually a bit embarrassed because I was like, I don't know. I don't know.
And I don't know where this is. I think this is from because we were all programmed maybe as little ones to think of poo as dirty or something along those lines. But, you know, as a two-year-old, we were fascinated with it.
Absolutely.
We were obsessed with what was in our nappies and, you know, kids do all kinds of crazy things with their poo when they're really young because they're obsessed with it.
Being potty trained, they get a treat.
And then at some point in time, our parents have said, oh no, that's dirty, that's bad, rather than that's just something we deal with and that's something we do every day. And we kind of need to, if there's parents out there, it's good to normalize the whole process. It's not dirty, it's just a waste removal from the body, and it actually gives us a lot of feedback of what in
key
terms of
indicator
what's going on inside. Body, it's the only way we can really tell on a daily basis. So I do encourage people not study it.
You don't have to get down on your knees in front of the bowl.
Just take
and look
a glance before you flush.
Yep.
Just to see what's going on, and then you can make some dietary changes and see whether that makes a difference to maybe some of your symptoms and what's going on from your. Yeah, from your
put it this way, if you're asked in a naturopathic consult,
please
give the naturopath the right feedback because you've looked inside the toilet bowl. I was so embarrassed. I was like, oh, I don't know. Anyway.
It's one thing I definitely won't go looking.
But Kate, it's not dirty. okay, what are some of the basic things that people can do at home to improve their gut health?
Oh, gosh, there's so many awesome things you can do. One of the things, so here's a little simple test that you can do to see whether you do have low stomach acid, or high stomach acid, in fact. If you put a bit of bicarb soda, and I mean like a quarter of a teaspoon, into about 3/4 to a cup of water, swig it down, but start your stopwatch. And see how long it takes before you burp.
Oh.
If you're a quick burper, it means you've got sufficient stomach acid. So if you burp within a minute, you've got relatively high stomach acid.
Yep.
If it takes optimal, would be between 1 and 3 minutes.
Okay.
That's like good range.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything longer than 3, 5 or beyond, you're getting lowish on your stomach acid. Beyond 5 minutes, you're really low. Or if you never burp, you're really low.
Wow.
And that's a simple way just to tell.
Okay.
I also look at fingernails and a few other things in clinic, but that's one of the key. I know it doesn't sound very scientific, but it does give you a bit of an indicator of what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, in terms of looking after the gut, if you find that you are getting bloating and you maybe did the burp test and you found that you were quite low, the most simplest thing to include in your diet is bitter foods.
Yep.
Like endive, rocket, radicchio, or those bitter lettuces are brilliant.
Yep.
Simple things like lemon in water is a good way to start before your meals, like 15 to 20 minutes before.
Warm or cold water?
Warm or cold's fine. I like having warm. I just feel more comfortable on my digestion, but it's really individual. And fresh lemon juice, like from a whole lemon, a whole lemon squeezed in. That will help stimulate the hydrochloric acid. If people are really low and they can tolerate it, I encourage even apple cider vinegar and start very low with that, like half a teaspoon, build up to a tablespoon in water, not straight. Again, before your meals, that's another alternative. But if people are sort of balking at that, then the lemon in water is a bit of a no-brainer. Most people can tolerate that.
So me having apple cider vinegar a little bit after a meal before bed, that's not a good time.
That's not really going to do the bitter job.
Okay.
That's not the bitter job.
Okay.
It has other properties
right
to do other things in the body, but not for the bitter stimulation, because you want the bitter react. We've got these receptors that go from our mouth all the way through our digestive tract. You want them to be ready and primed before you put food in. To stimulate
I totally get
the hydrochloric acid.
Yep.
You know, that's in the stomach.
I need to shift that.
So getting the stomach ready beforehand. When you trigger off hydrochloric acid in our mouth, that also sends a signal to the pancreas to release the digestive enzymes. You know, protease for protein, amylase, lipase for fats. Amylase is for our starches and for our carbohydrates.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thank you.
So we need all that to be happening through the digestive tract. And it happens in the background. Mm. But the key is to starting the cascade with the hydrochloric acid.
Yeah.
You know, and with our saliva. And and again, that's all about the slow mastication, chewing our food properly, all that stuff.
Is it almost like just warming the body? This is what's about to happen.
Okay, you're about to get ready.
Start
rather than chucking the brick down.
Rather than chucking the brick down.
Now, when people do have a lot of inflammation through their gut, some of the other just basic stuff that they can do at home are things like having really good anti-inflammatory foods. Foods that are high in quercetin. Quercetin is in things like brown rice, apples, dill, capers, quinoa. It's in a whole range of things. Quercetin is really nice and anti-inflammatory for the gut. Really nice and anti-inflammatory.
How do you spell quercetin?
Q-U-E-R-C-I-T-N.
Beautiful.
Quercetin.
Okay. Quercetin.
Am I saying it right? Q-U-E-R. Yeah. Quercetin. C-E-T-I-N.
Because I've just learned a new
word. Quercetin. Good. Yeah, and that's anti-inflammatory for the gut. And then if we just remember all of the other basic anti-inflammatory foods, like our fish, high quality, the oily, deep sea oily fish, things like chia, a yummy chia pudding gives you protein and the high quality essential fatty acids and gives you the fiber for your gut as
well. So easy to make.
Yeah. Flaxseed's another winner as well, because it's got the fatty acids and good fiber for the gut. And I think aside from these great anti-inflammatory stuff, in the anti-inflammatory camp, things that are high in vitamin A or the precursor called beta carotene, just think orange foods, orange and yellow veggies. They're the ones with the beta carotene. Again, our gut needs quite a lot of vitamin A. And if we've got a bit of malabsorption going on, like with those fat-soluble vitamins, vitamin A might be a little bit low. So having those beautiful colours
helps.
Really helps, like it helps for that. But the key that I think most people are really aware of is fibre. And people will sometimes get a little bit confused between the term probiotic and prebiotic. So the prebiotic is the fibres. There's multiple types, but let's just call them fibers that feed our microbiome, which is all of our bacteria. We've got over 1,000 species in the gut.
Quick question, Kate.
Yes.
The microbiome, your bacteria and your viruses and the fungi.
It's everything in there.
Okay, gotcha. All right, carry
on. It's a whole collection of them.
And they weigh a lot.
Oh, yeah. Look, we're made up of more microbes than we are actually cells in our own body.
So
And they play such an important role.
One day we'll do a podcast on the microbiome.
Just the microbiome.
It's
so huge.
Interesting.
It's a huge topic.
Anyway, go back to prebiotic.
But when everything's in balance there, it all works well.
Yep.
It's when some of the opportunistic bacteria take over where there's problems.
Yeah.
And we'll get those same symptoms that we talked about before, the bloating, mucus in the stool, uncomfortable, you know, cramping or pain or, you know, and we tend to find that chronically, not just when we're running.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So back to the microbiome and feeding it with prebiotics and probiotics. So the prebiotics are the fibers that provide, that the beneficial microbiome feeds on in our gut. So they use that as food and they break it down into what's called short chain fatty acids in our gut. That is the, that's what our colon cells thrive on.
Colon health is critical for digestion.
Because that's where a lot of our absorption and our B12 is activated and like a whole range of stuff's all happening down, you know, in the colon. So the key is to having enough fiber, not too much fiber, but enough fiber. So, and the simple way of doing that is just to have things that have got, you know, things like kiwi that have got lots of fiber in them.
Eat the skin.
Eat the skin of fruits and vegetables. You know, we don't need to peel carrots.
No.
Just scrub them, eat them.
We don't need to peel anything except oranges and bananas.
Maybe pineapples.
Oh, yep. Maybe pineapples.
Maybe that's avocados.
Okay, there's a few.
There's a few bananas. But, you know, there's some real goodies in terms of things that will also really provide us with lots of the kind of fiber that our gut loves.
Whole grains, that's all high in fiber.
Whole grains, brilliant.
Yep.
But resistant starch, which is in things like bananas, asparagus, artichoke, garlic, leek, onions, our gut loves that. If you're not FODMAP intolerant, and we're not going down that path today, but most people find that they do really well on those kind of foods in terms of fiber.
Jump into probiotics.
Okay, so they're the beneficial bacteria that are already in our gut, but when we take a supplement probiotic, we're providing either a singular strain or multiple collection of those beneficial bacteria to go back into our microbiome. There is some of what we call commensurate bacteria, beneficial probiotics, and they're thing like called, there's lots and lots of different strains. The microbiome has strains a little bit like species of plants, you know, in terms of
all different kinds.
Yeah. And they've all got a specific action. For example, like rhamnosus, great for diarrhea. Lactobacillus is great for a whole range of things, but especially after you've had antibiotics and things like that. People who are dairy intolerant are often low on lactobacillus as well. So there's, and there's lots of different strains. Even under lactobacillus, there's lots of different substrains. So without getting too caught up in the detail, the probiotics are the beneficial bacteria.
So if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, oh shit, I've never had a prebiotic, I've never had a probiotic, I don't know if I need one, should people be taking them? Or should they be seeing you first or someone first?
Well, it's a little bit, it's a little bit like the question, should I take multivitamins?
Yeah.
And it's really dependent on what's going on in your gut, rather than self-prescribing, because you can take, and again, it's like a probiotic can be, we can get general strains. For some people, they get worse.
Yeah.
Because they're actually putting in strains that are causing problems, and there's ways to actually go about it. I like to put in some of the commensurate bacteria first that get the, that are the team players, like Saccharomyces boulardii, which isn't a true probiotic, but it gets all the team working together, for example.
Good. I like teamwork.
Yeah, and then depending on what the physical symptoms are, you know, eczema, for example, needs a certain strain versus, you know, diarrhea.
Yeah,
you know, we use slightly different strains.
Yeah.
So taking a general probiotic, it may or may not, you know, it's a bit of a shotgun approach.
Yeah, totally.
You know what I mean?
It's got to be so individual and specific, really.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. So, consult someone.
And I think you've also got to be mindful that things termed probiotics, some of them have not been handled properly. So they're not actually even alive.
Right. Yeah.
So shelf-based stuff or mainstream general stuff that we might purchase, they may not have been stored properly. Yeah, so they might actually, you know, the you see on the bottles, they'll have a count of million or billion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And some of them might, you know, only have a small amount.
Yeah.
If they haven't been stored properly. Right. There's a certain level of standards that needs to be adhered to, and that's why I do recommend people get quality probiotics rather than going for something that claims to be a probiotic but has got one strain in it, or you know, doesn't have any research behind it, because it's just stabbing in the dark there.
Yeah, so don't guess, people. If you don't know, see someone and identify whether or not you know you need one, and exactly what you need.
Yeah.
Kate, if runners are concerned about their symptoms, any kind of gut health symptoms or their visits to the toilet or whatever it is, they're concerned they're not resolving, and this runner, for example, believes that they've got a good diet, they're doing all the right things, but whatever their symptoms are, be it bloating, diarrhea, trouble, you know, during training runs or races, what should they do?
Yeah. Generally speaking, I'd probably, if it's constant and they've tried a few different things like pulling out some of the aggravators, we haven't actually talked about that. Maybe we should touch on some of those things, because some of those are really easy for people to change immediately. And one of the things I find, we were talking about this before, Soph, was that people associate food with gut problems and they forget about the liquids. So they forget about possibly having too much electrolyte. Like if you're having too much magnesium, it'll give you the runs. Definitely the most common thing I find in clinic is caffeine. And people forget.
Let's go there on the caffeine. I reckon there's a lot of coffee drinkers listening to this.
I'm not against caffeine. Caffeine is performance enhancing if you use it wisely. But when people are chronic caffeine users, whether that be through you know, tablets or whatever means, or just through coffee, some people forget, you know, they may be having 2, 3, or 4 coffees, and then I say, well, single or doubles? Oh yeah, I'm having doubles. Oh my God, you're up to 800 to 1,000 milligrams of caffeine. That's huge.
And then that's just from coffee.
Just from coffee. And then they may have a Coke after work, or they may have some chocolate or tea or other stuff with a bit of caffeine. And so it's getting right up there. Caffeine is very inflammatory on the gut. Some people are more sensitive than others, though. And we think of caffeine often revving our nervous system up. You know, it gives us that. It does circulate greater blood flow to the brain, so people get that clarity of thought sometimes, or they might get that pick me up in energy, but it's very short lived. So it has the effects here on the nervous system, but where I see it by far the most in terms of its effect is on the gut. And it's a little bit like popping some sandpaper down there and giving it a good rub when we're having high volumes. It just stirs up the inflammation. And then often we'll find that people with coffee, they may or may not be having that black or white. So if they're also having dairy, and they're having quite a lot of dairy, and I'm not against dairy, but if people are sensitive to it, or they've got an unknown intolerance to it, and the same with wheat-based products, so they might be having lots of triggers that they're unaware of that will all kind of come together collaboratively and cause this inflammation. And the key I would suggest is back off your coffee. That's the first thing to see whether that makes a difference, especially if you're getting frequency of bowel motion or urgency. And you'll know this. You know, people will go, I can't go to the toilet until I've had a coffee. And then they'll go, and then I go 4 times. Well, hello, there's that link. Just have a think about it. Just listen to the body and go, okay, maybe I'll see how I go on half a shot of coffee. See how I go on quarter of a shot of coffee. And reduce it back to the point where you feel good on coffee, but you're not getting the symptoms.
Perfect.
Because if you love a good cup of coffee, enjoy it. You don't have to deny yourself that, but just pull it back to a level that's good for you. And it's so individual. So individual. The other thing that I find that people don't link to tummy problems is things like chewing gum that have got those alcohol sugars in them or artificial sweeteners, the sorbitol, mannitol, all those ones. They can really stir up the gut and cause a lot of bloating and all the rest of it.
So chewy's not good for us.
Chewy's not great for us, and it contains other things like phenylalanine and a whole range of stuff that can then screw with our neurotransmitters in our brain and do a whole range of stuff. And unfortunately, it's promoted heavily to people as a diet stuff. Like we see a lot of the artificial sweeteners that are also in soft drinks and stuff like that. And unfortunately, now the research really clearly shows it actually stimulates our sugar receptors. So we actually want more sweet stuff when we have the diet products. It's really cruel, but smart on one side of the industry, but not so great on our health side of things. So we're much better off going back to natural sugars if we want a sugar fix. You know, I'm talking fruit and stuff like that.
So people have done a little bit of help themselves in terms of cutting out a few of the things.
Yeah.
Symptoms are still...
still persisting and getting worse. Yeah. Then I would definitely see someone. And there are... we've come a long way in terms of how we now test in Australia. And there is some stool testing that relies more on DNA of pathogens. So we can see whether there is bacterial overgrowth, whether there's worms, other parasites, viruses, things like H. pylori, which is responsible for ulcers and reflux, for example. We can test all of that in a simple stool test now. So we've come quite a long way. And we used to have to send these tests off to America and they cost you thousands of dollars.
That's incredible.
But now we can do it in Australia. It's much easier to do it. And it's fairly quick turnaround in terms of the results as well. And it's really simple. So
don't be embarrassed, people. Just don't put up with it. Don't be embarrassed.
And it's, you do it in the privacy of your own home. You don't have to go into a clinic or anything.
But that's when you've seen someone first.
When you've seen someone first.
The starting point is reaching out.
Absolutely.
To speak to a professional.
Yeah. And look, some doctors are across gut health and others aren't. It is the domain of naturopaths or nutritionists to really know gut health inside out, back to front. That's our mainstay. That's what we really focus on a lot.
Bread and butter.
And our philosophy is that everything starts with the gut, because if we're not absorbing our food properly and not getting the nutrients, the whole body suffers. You know, it's not isolated. It doesn't operate on its own. It sends all the messages and all the nutrients our entire body needs. So we always tend to go back to the gut and work out what's going on there before we...
Which makes so much sense why the start of a consultation is, tell me what's going into your body. Tell me what you're eating. Rather than, what are your symptoms? You know? Tell me about your... Let's set it up holistically. What I like about
naturopathy. So we look at the whole picture.
Kate, I think we've done pretty well on gut health. Is there any little gaps that you think we've missed that have popped into your head that you want to cover off before we get to listener questions?
Oh gosh, there's so many things. I think
there's so many things.
There's so many things. And I think we can also get caught up in supplements and products and everything else. But the best thing we can do for our gut is actually just eat real food. Eating around the outside of a supermarket, for example. Not going down the middle of the aisles. Taking out, and this is a great way to actually monitor it as well.
Can you say that again? Eat around the outside of a supermarket. That's good.
Because all the rubbish is in the middle aisles. Eating like a rainbow. So we've got a full, colourful plate. Even things like 40 food challenge is great. And if you haven't done that before, it's just simply writing down at the end of the week how many food groups you've had. So strawberries, for example, is one. Tomato is another. You know, capsicum's a third. And seeing whether you can get up to 40, because 40 really means that you're having decent variety in your diet.
That's really cool.
And you rotate it each week, right?
Take it on. Take the challenge on.
So that means you're getting exposure to a whole range of different nutrients, and you're getting lots of fiber because you'd have to. But it's real food. A packet of Tim Tams does not count.
No.
It has to be real food.
If you had to rip the plastic off, that's not one for your full
It has to be real food. No plastic. But the other great way to measure it is how much whole foods you're having is just to look at your waste bin. Because real food is not wrapped in crap. It's real food. So our waste disposal goes right down. So we're not buying stuff. That's wrapped in disposable stuff. The other thing that comes up a lot is about fermented products or fermented foods. And we can make all these things at home, like our kefir and our sauerkraut and our kimchi. If we're getting a lot of bloating already, I recommend people probably avoid that for a little while until they've had some investigations done to work out what's going on. But if you're healthy and you want to just maintain gut health, including that in your diet, is a winner, because that's actually helping the microbiome thrive as well.
I don't want that stuff.
Yeah, so I'm talking sauerkraut, you know, your fermented cabbage. Yeah, yeah. It's used in European cultures a lot, but we can make it at home.
I buy it out of the jar.
You can buy it out of the jar, yeah. But literally it's a grated cabbage with salted water.
Yeah.
You don't add anything else. True. It's so easy. It's so cheap. You can make it for $3 or less. But miso, you know, Japanese love it. Yeah. It's awesome. A really good miso is delicious.
Yeah.
Kombucha's become really trendy, and I've got to say, it's become a little bit like bastardized, a little bit like a soft drink.
Yeah, it totally.
So some of the kombuchas are super high in sugar and aren't that great. But again, you can brew it at home, cheap, really easy, and you can flavor it. I make one at home in a big batch. I've got this old wine vat that's just glass, and we make ginger. And we make it out of red leaf tea, you know, South African red leaf tea. And it's delicious. You can, and we think of kefir, if you've heard of kefir. Kefir is fermented yogurt.
Yep.
That is great for the gut.
Yeah,
and a lot of people who can't even tolerate dairy will be able to tolerate that because it's broken down, it's fermented.
Okay, of course,
So it's already partially on its way.
Yep.
And you can also have a crack at making your own coconut kefir if you're dairy intolerant as well. You can just get the same strains and then create it at home.
Yeah,
it's easy.
I think one of your an upcoming Instagram post could be a link to your kombucha home recipe.
I'll do that. Cool. Yeah.
I'll remind you.
And I've also got lots of, if people are listening and they're after some tips and tricks and stuff like that, I do have lots of posts and stuff on my website about gut health, but I've also got a little downloadable meal or snacks that I've put into a little mini e-recipe book, and they're all very gut-friendly snacks that athletes can make. So they're welcome to download that for free and just have a crack at making a few of them.
Yeah, that's
they're
really great. Easy. That's on Kate's website, which is www.athletesanctuary.com.au, but we'll link to that. From today.
Cool.
The Arthur's Seat Challenge 6.7 kilometre fun run and walk will be held on Sunday the 10th of November, starting at 8:30 a.m. in Rosebud and finishing at Arthur's Seat. This event is held each year to raise awareness and funds for the Fit to Drive road safety program that is delivered to Year 11 students, where they learn attitudes and behaviours to make them better drivers and passengers. The Arthur's Seat Challenge is a fantastic community event for families, schools, individuals, community groups, sporting groups, and local businesses. Sporting groups are invited to put together a team and challenge their rival clubs. Register and pay by the 13th of October for your chance to win a 30-minute personal training session with Carly and a one-week guest pass at Anytime Fitness Mornington. A large number of volunteers are needed to run the event, so anyone who is unable to enter is welcome to help out on the day. There are a number of roles available, including bib allocation and course marshals. Medals are awarded to male and female overall place getters and age category winners, and perpetual shields are awarded to the largest school team, largest community team, and fastest team. All entrants receive a participation medal. More details about the Arthur's Seat Challenge can be found at www.arthursseatchallenge.com.au.
Kate, we're going to dive into some listener questions.
Good.
But if little things pop up that you might have forgotten or I didn't ask about gut health, just slot it in.
I will.
I reckon. We go.
Yeah.
This question comes from Lionel, and he asks, what was your worst injury and how did you cope mentally during recovery?
Oh, would you like me to take that one?
Yeah, you can.
I don't know. We think of injuries as being physical injuries, and sure, I had a couple of calf ones and they were pretty damn painful.
I actually remember one of your calf
ones. One of them was 10 centimetres right through the middle of the gastroc, but you know what, with the right treatment that totally repaired in 10 days, which was really freaky how quickly the calves can repair if you do the right things.
Muscles.
Yeah, but I'd have to say one of my a couple of them, another one, the most painful one that actually ended my career, was osteopubitis. That hurts when you got fluid on the pubic bone, and I think men and women can suffer from that, but that's not a pretty one. But I think also injuries we forget about, organ injury. And by far my greatest injury that put me out of action for the longest was liver issues.
And was that after the Com Games?
Yeah, it was after that. And it was when I was undiagnosed with celiac. So I had systemic inflammation that was causing a lot of problems through my liver.
Yeah.
And that was a bugger because I had to take a good 6 months off. And I was I don't think you probably remember, but I was my immune system was not able to kind of heal itself, and I had to literally do 48 hours of sensory deprivation, they call it. It's an extreme measure when your immune system just ain't gonna work properly. And I was in a darkened room for 48 hours sleeping, and really? I didn't eat. Food was brought to my door if I wanted it, but I wasn't allowed to have any stimulation, writing or reading, nothing, no light, so no telly, nothing for 48 hours. I just had to rest. But my God, that was amazing. Coming out of that, it was like I was a different person, and I was like I'd given myself a chance to start to heal at a cellular level without overloading again. And then from there I was allowed to walk for 3 months. I was allowed to just slowly repair. I was on an absolute 100% anal whole foods diet, like nothing outside of vegetables, fruits and lean animal products. That's it. 3 months.
Wow.
I came out the other end and I was fully restored.
Incredible.
And then I rebounded and ran the fastest
marathon you'd ever done.
Yeah. Crazy.
Do you think that's where your interest in naturopathy was born?
Absolutely. Because I went through this, and I think most people who are drawn to healthcare have had some kind of challenge themselves. Yep. And certainly that's what enabled me to look outside the square, because I was on a study at the time at the AIS, and unfortunately for the scientists that I was on study for, I buggered up their data. Because I had to leave the study because I was so sick, and my liver enzymes were higher than a chronic alcoholic.
Oh,
and they're like, "How are you drinking?" And I'm like, "Hello, I haven't drunk in 10 years. Like, what are you talking about?
Get that girl out of the pub, please."
Yeah, but what it meant was I had to go home and start exploring who could help me, and mainstream couldn't help me. And that's when I found naturopaths and other methods of looking into people or athletes holistically. And that's what really started my journey.
Yeah.
Off down this path. Yeah.
Great question, Lionel. That's really informative. We've just got to ask, do you have a favorite sock for wet weather?
That's one for you.
Yeah. The answer to that is no. I don't have a favorite sock for wet weather. If I know it's going to be raining outside, I don't change what socks I'm going to be wearing, and I don't talk to my patients about changing socks for wet weather. I think footwear is important, especially if you're going to be running on trails or running on different surfaces, that when they are wet, it is more likely that you're going to slip and fall and that sort of stuff. I think it's better to think more about your clothing and what you're wearing to try and stay as dry as you can so you don't get too cold. But in terms of your socks, I think if it's wet, if it's pouring rain outside, if you're going to be splashing around in puddles, you're probably going to get wet regardless. Your feet are going to get wet regardless of the socks you're wearing.
What about, is there a difference between fibers? What's better when it's wet, like bamboo or cotton or the synthetic?
I haven't done a lot of extensive research into the fibers of the socks, but they will all get wet, and your risk of blisters is probably fairly similar, I would imagine. I'm a podiatrist, but I haven't done a lot of research into the fabrics. But I think if you're, like, blisters are caused by moisture and friction. And I think if your footwear, the type of activity that you're doing, and your biomechanics are predisposing you to blisters, yes, it might be slightly reduced if you wear a softer sock, for example.
But it might be more to do with the way the shoe's fitting.
It's probably to do with the shoe, potentially the seams and the stitching from the shoe, how you're running is probably got more to do with it. I'm not a huge fan of thick socks, and I know Thorlows were all the rage for so long, but to me a thick sock is just more fabric to hold moisture. So I would always go with something a little bit thinner, and that's whether it's wet, whether it's dry, whether you're racing, whether you're training. I just think slightly thinner socks that just hug or slightly compress your foot almost a tiny little bit are just really comfortable.
Cool.
And the fibers, are kind of important, but I think it's just about finding something that feels really good when you're running in it, and what it's actually made of, and the thickness, is probably slightly secondary.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's just horses for courses. Everyone's you know, individual. It's just like footwear. I mean, the theory of so many shoes supports it. This person must wear that shoe, and the reality and the clinical setting, it's so different to that. You know, that this person, you know, theoretically belongs in this shoe or whatever, and it's just, it's what actually feels good. And you know, sometimes finding that, just, you know, experimenting a little bit and finding what works and sticking with it.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay, Kate, what's the toughest workout you've ever completed? When was it?
Oh my god, I probably haven't.
What was it?
I probably have a couple here. One was a track session, and I didn't use it that often. I've got to put a context on this one. It wasn't one I did week in, week out. It was a super duper, right, I am ready to absolutely fire.
Yep.
And this one was 24 800s. On a track, and I'd do 800 hard and then 800 float. And the float was only 15 seconds slower than the hard.
And what was the hard run in, do you reckon?
Oh, the pace. The pace would have been around 310 pace.
So 310 per K pace? Or yeah. 310 for your 800?
No, 310 per K pace, right, around that, between 305 and 310.
Far out.
And then under that would have been up to 330 for the recovery, I'd say. 330, 335, around that.
Yep.
And I used to do that at Olympic Park when we had the track down there.
Yep.
And that was crazy.
Did you do it with someone?
And no, I was often the only crazy one who would do it.
Yeah, right.
But I would often get someone to come down and keep me on track. And that was the only way. So I'd just, use it as a great tool to practice my mindset stuff and programming my mind, to stay on track as well. Right. And then the other long one, I worked with a lovely Kiwi coach in the last phase of my career, John Bowden. And John was from Lydiard's descendant. He was a Lydiard descendant from Arthur Lydiard's training from New Zealand. And they trained a little bit differently to the way that we did in Australia. And so I switched onto that style of programming in those last couple of years. And we did extension runs once a month for marathons specific when I was just in the specific phase. So nothing to do with 10K or halves. It was all about marathon. And so my extension was anywhere between 43 and 44. And I'd do that between 330 and 345 pace, or up to 350 sometimes pace.
That's incredible.
It was ridiculous. Ridiculous. But again, and then I'd have several days off. It was just purely about high-end aerobic
at 335 to 350 pace.
Yeah.
Out at Lilydale?
That was my favourite.
Yeah, Lilydale, Warburton. Yeah.
Good on you. And the bugger of the course was that on the way back it's uphill. So it mimics races. It makes it harder on the second half.
Yeah.
But again, it wasn't used all the time and it was very selectively placed in a program.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that'd definitely have to be my toughest.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Brooke asks, what is plantar fasciitis and how do people avoid it? She's also asked, why do we crave sugar and salt? So I think we know who takes which part of the question and who takes the other.
Sure.
Okay, plantar fasciitis is... So when we think about the bottom of the foot, we have a dense fibrous ligament called the plantar fascia. It attaches at the heel bone, the calcaneus, and stretches to insert in at the toes. It is a bit of a bugger of a thing if you've injured your plantar fascia, and we tend to talk more as plantar fasciitis or plantar heel pain, and pain around the bottom of the heel, particularly upon standing first thing in the morning or upon loading after periods of sitting, can be quite a lot of pain at the bottom of the heel or the foot. That pain, I don't like to call it inflammation necessarily, because we're not even positive that there are the presence of inflammatory cells. So I think of it more as increased pressure from the ground that compresses the tissue under the heel, or just increased stress around that attachment side. And most people are fairly tender right at the plantar aspect or the very bottom of the heel, or even around the side on the inside, which is the medial calcaneal tubercle, and it's one of the attachment sites of the plantar fascia. So that's sort of a broad, what is plantar fasciitis? How do we avoid it? I don't think of avoidance, I more think of prevention. How do we prevent it? As podiatrists, we see tight calves go hand in hand with plantar heel pain. If you've got really, really tight calves, that fascia that attaches and becomes the plantar fascia, that fascia has to start somewhere, and it starts way up higher in the body, much, 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 much higher. But think more, a little bit more locally, and think of your calves. So you know, the whole posterior chain, really, the low back, glutes, hamstrings, calves, and into the foot. So managing the fascial health, myofascial health of that whole posterior chain will do a lot of things to help manage or prevent plantar fasciitis. So
we're talking active stretching, so for
stretching, massage.
Massage, yeah.
Incorporating some strengthening.
Yeah.
But particularly trigger point therapy, dry needling, yeah, and myofascial work, as I'm doing now.
That works well.
Into my calf, into your calves.
And roller,
all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
Changing your shoes as frequently as you can. You know, we look at sort of 600 to 750 kilometers on a pair of shoes will really help. Training surfaces, so the kind of what you're running on, break it up a bit and get off the concrete and the roads to some softer surfaces like trails and the grass and that sort of thing. But I think if you have a really acute and sound awareness of your body, plantar fasciitis will sort of just creep up on you. But if you're sore in the heel, you know, address it straight away. Don't wait until you literally are hobbling out of bed of a morning. You know, if you're sore, get in and see someone straight away, because we can tape you up. I do a lot of shockwave therapy on plantar fasciitis patients. Dry needling works incredibly well. But most of all, we can look at your biomechanics. We can say, okay, why are you loading or overloading that plantar fascia or that fascial attachment? And what can we do to redistribute forces, ground reaction forces, and load so that we are not loading up that poor tender little spot on your heel?
Mm.
So we can do that with some very simple generic prefabricated orthotics or something a little bit more more customized, or it might not be orthotics at all. It might be footwear. Looking at your lifestyle, if you're standing on your feet 10, 12, 14 hours a day on hard floors in terrible shoes, your plantar fascia ain't loving you very much. Mm. So lifestyle is massive. Yeah. So yeah, we really look at everything. Lifestyle, biomechanics, training, and then all the other things, like the little ways that you're helping your body, like massage and all that stuff.
Cool.
Why do we crave sugar and salt?
Oh gosh, well, there's a few different things and there's a few different theories on this, but salt can be because we're not actually having enough in our diet. And this is with athletes who are very good in many ways with their diet, and they're not having processed foods, so they're fairly low in sodium intake, or they're excreting a lot of sodium, like high sweat rates, for example. So you will actually crave it if you need it. But the other reason can be if there's adrenal stress. That's one of the first signs that I see people start to crave. So the adrenal gland is one gland that needs a lot of sodium. The other thing we see with sugar is blood sugar. Blood sugar dysregulation, most definitely. Like if people are starting to get dizzy, they're either not eating enough, not eating the right foods, not having enough protein frequently throughout the day. Like we need to drip feed our protein, not just have it for dinner. And it can also be you can be a bit low in magnesium if you're craving sugary stuff as well. And again, that's more to do with magnesium helping with blood sugar regulation. They're the main things, and unfortunately with things that are sweet, as soon as we open that gate we start craving more and more. And it's tricky because you get into this vicious cycle. You have a little bit, you want more, you have more, you want more. So it's one of those things that you just want to manage carefully. You can crave carbs generally and sweet stuff if you're simply not having enough carbohydrates in your diet and you're not having the right kinds.
It's a major fuel source.
We need it. We need it, but we need to choose the complex, low GI, the ones with lots of fiber. Just think fiber and carbohydrate, the whole grains, rather than having processed quick oats, have whole oats, you know, rather than having a bar. You know, a muesli bar, have real fruit and nuts. You know, like it's pretty.
Actually, something I thought of when you were talking about the gut health is I think as runners, we fear fiber because you think, oh, high in fiber, off to the toilet, you know, but we've got to embrace fiber.
Embrace fiber. And it can actually help regulate your bowel motion because it can actually fill out. Like, because the other issue is that we can be having too much fluid right before we run as well, or fluid that's high in fructose or something that irritates the gut that causes diarrhea.
Yeah.
So there's multiple factors going on there. You can't blame it on fiber. Sure, if we're having something that's super high in fiber right before we run, well, that's going to happen simply because blood leaves our gut when we start exercising. It goes out to the working muscles. So, but that's going to happen no matter what you eat right before you run. So I encourage people to eat, you know, give it some time, an hour at least minimum before you run.
Kate, I think we've got a lot of listener questions. However, there's a couple that are so good we're going to do specific, what do you call them, episodes or, you know, discussions on them. So to all the people who did send in those questions, thank you so much for being so interested and engaged. We will get to you. Like, I'm really determined to answer a few of these because I think they're absolute crackers. But I don't want to skim the surface and not do the question justice when we can actually do a pretty good deep dive into them. So I think we're going to wrap it up because you've got a list of patients. I've got a list of patients that we need to get to. Thank you so much, Kate, for your time. Can you please just refresh everyone's memory of where your clinics are, how they can see you, and how they can find you online?
So my clinic is called the Athlete Sanctuary, S-A-N-C-T-U-A-R-Y, and I have in-clinic sessions in Ballarat, in Melbourne, and in Torquay or Janjuk. And but I do find a lot of athletes are now consulting with me online, which is really convenient. They can do it anytime and wherever they're based. So that's really easy for people.
Cool. Yeah, website, find me. athletesanctuary.com.au.
That's it, yes.
And on where can people find you on Instagram?
Instagram is Kate Smyth Sports Naturopath.
Kate Smyth Sports Naturopath. That's cool.
Yeah.
And a link to that little ebook that's got the little...
That's on the website.
Beautiful. Cool.
Yeah.
That's on the website. That's really helpful.
A little drop-down box will flash up when people go to the website and they can just pop in their name and they'll get sent the little ebook.
Brilliant. Kate, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
It's been a delight talking to you. And we'll be picking your brain sometime soon.
Good.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks again to this weekend's sponsor, the Arthur's Seat Challenge Fun Run and Walk. Make sure you sign up at arthurseatchallenge.com.au by October the 13th for your chance to win a PT session and a one-week gym pass. Hope you enjoy the show. I was told as a young man, doesn't matter if you're white or black. Just show love to everyone you meet, doesn't matter if it don't